Here are my idea. Coming in. From the Jeremiah lesson that I want to take away, and that's why it's in this part of the quarter, is just emphasizing the relationship piece of just how much it is that relationships, people, discouragement from people are what can bring us down. It looks like Jeremiah's painful relationship, the social side, right, is what gets him down the most. I know he physically suffered. You can see that in the book of Lamentations. But it's the shame. These are social words, right? Shame, scorn, reproach, people hating him, betrayal, rejection, loneliness. All of those are social things. Not good relationships, bad relationships. There's that funny line of everybody hates me and I don't even owe them money, right? I mean, it's Jeremiah, so it's not going to be like ha-ha hilarious, but it is a funny line, right? And so everybody hates me. And I just suspect we can relate to this, that it's the relationship side of things in life of where things can become so difficult, so unbearable, right? On the job, it's, you know, how are things with the people around you? Are they hateful, mean? Do you feel isolated, alone, unfairly treated, right? In your house, in your home, at a church, in a marriage, you name it, it's those relationship pieces that can just make things so hard. Julianne has a quote, it's still in her bedroom, actually. Henry made it for her at Simply Pottery because it was a quote that she was thinking about a lot when her back pain was so bad back in October. And the gist of the quote is, one of the sweet things about pain is it's God's way of showing you how much the people around you love you and care about you, right? So when you're going through something difficult, that then allows these beautiful moments from the people around you and their help. But what that's saying is that even though you're going through something really hard, relationships can still blossom and encourage us and bring us through those hardships. What's the opposite? Yeah, if your health is good, but you're in such a bad place where you feel like you're rejected, isolated, lonely, ashamed, reproached, then that's where life is just unbearable. Obviously, pain can bring us down. Obviously, chronic pain especially can bring us down. But it's people who really make everything else miserable and unendurable. So Jeremiah leans on God through all this, of course, right? Great example of Jeremiah looking to God, talking to God, bringing his complaint, articulating those things to God. Those are such important exercises for us, not general prayers, specific prayers to God. So Jeremiah's faithful, and he's a very good example for us, but that doesn't mean it was easy. It was still a very difficult thing to go through. Here's a great proverb that kind of hits on this idea. Proverbs 18:14. A man's spirit will endure sickness, but a crushed spirit who can bear? And I realize that relationships aren't specifically mentioned in this verse, but what does that verse teach us about human nature? A man's spirit will endure sickness, but a crushed spirit, who can bear that?
It reminds me of the concentration camp thought that as long as they could keep their spirit.
And hope, yeah.
And hope. That would keep them going. But yes. As soon as they lost that, it was a lost cause.
That's it. That's right. Exactly. Good. What else do we see with this about human nature? Is physical sickness the kind of worst thing to happen to us? No, in fact, physical sickness, but when we have encouragement and a heart, that could be the emotional side of things. That could be that our thinking stays right. It could be that our relationships stay encouraging. Fine. But when our spirit gets crushed, that's when life becomes unbearable. So the point is then just don't underestimate just how bad our emotions can make things, right? Well, I just have these problems, but I don't have the back pain that Julianne has. Well, just remember that your crushed spirit might be more unendurable. You know what I mean? That idea. Yeah, Heather.
This, along with something you said a couple weeks ago, has made me think a little bit about how we view abuse sometimes. And sometimes we'll say things like, well, you know, he didn't break your nose. Like, his word may have crushed your spirit, but mm-hmm. you break your nose. Like, it's not physical abuse.
Yeah,
it hasn't
yeah.
risen to that level. But these passages seem to indicate the opposite. Like, the nose can heal. That crushed spirit, that's really serious.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
It makes me think, like, maybe I have not always given that the weight that it means. Maybe even in our culture, we don't always give it the weight that it means. Like,
yeah, yeah.
Just because he's not beating you doesn't mean, or she, I know that can be reversed.
Sure, sure. The context of pain is everything, right? One pain measure can produce trauma and difficulty your whole life. One pain measure, we accept it, welcome it, pay for it. Because this is a representation of hatred, neglect, right? My needs not being met, etc. Whereas this over here is cancer treatment, which is painful, awful, but I want it, I'm asking for it, I'm paying for it. It's still the same pain, but it's totally—it's the context that makes those two different things. And so that one of those crushes our spirit when it's hopelessness, hatefulness, et cetera, versus one that can be very encouraging, you know, kind of thing. So we bear sickness, we bear broken bones, right? Financial challenges. We maybe face all those with fine colors. But when our spirit is really down, that's when it's unbearable, right? So when you're going through a hard time, when you feel like Jeremiah or Job or Jesus or Paul, you name it, remember that God knows how hard it is. God's the one who put this in the Bible. God put in the Proverbs, who can bear a crushed spirit? So God can help us, of course. That's not the point. The point is, it is a hardship. It is a difficult thing. So that's what I have on the Jeremiah stuff. I realize that Eric covered that. I realize he did not get through everything, but we're going to just have to move forward overall to cover what we want to in this quarter. So any comments, questions that you had on the Jeremiah material? So let's move forward then to look at Psalm 142 and this whole idea of relationship with God versus relationship with people. I have someone to read out loud. The ESV is going to be up here the entire psalm, but can someone read out loud Psalm 142 for us?
With my voice I cry out to the Lord. My voice I plead for mercy to the Lord. I pour out my complaint before him. I tell my trouble before him. When my spirit faints within me, you know my way. In the path where I walk, they have hidden a trap for me. Look to the right and see. There is none who takes notice of me. No refuge remains to me. No one cares for my soul. I cry to you, O Lord. I say, you are my refuge, my portion in the land of the living. Attend to my cry, for I am brought very low. Deliver me from my persecutors, for they are too strong for me. Bring me out of prison, that I may give thanks to your name. The righteous will surround me, for you will deal bountifully with me.
Okay, so the questions that I asked on here. What are some practical things David does when he's in the pit? This is my lame joke. Technically, the cave, right? That's what the title of the Psalms is, before verse 1, when he's in the cave. Although he describes it as, verse 7, bring me out of prison. Does he ever call it the pit in here? Trap. Verse 3, in the trap for me. Anyways. Okay, what are some things that David does when he's in the pit? He does. Cries out to God. He articulates. He gives some specific details. What are just some specific things that he says to God in this short psalm?
He feels weak.
Feels weak, and
others have set traps for him.
Yep. He tells God. I mean, God knows that. God knows all these things, but he talks to God about it. Says those things to God. Yeah, no one's there. Verse 4, look to the right, see, there's no one who takes notice of me. No refuge remains. No one cares about my soul. Obviously, he turns to God. But there feels like no one is caring for him. Good. What else? What else are some practical things that David does here in the pit? Okay, so he tells himself truths that are hard to believe at times, like Everything's going to be okay. End of verse 7. You will deal bountifully with me. But he tells himself the truth. Now that, if this was a psychology context, we would call that cognitive behavioral therapy. You tell yourself the truth. Keep telling yourself the truth. It's hard to believe. Fill your mind with those truths. So I did a series of lessons, not on this topic, not on this quarter's topic. Last October in Tuscaloosa, I did just my series that I do everywhere. I've done it like 8 times, the A New Start in Christ. And this lady comes up to me after on Sunday, and she had things in her schedule, so she couldn't come on Friday or Saturday, but she came Sunday of the meeting. And she comes up to me, she says, the stuff that you're talking about sounds just like cognitive behavioral therapy. I'm a cognitive behavioral therapist, and I'm gonna be like, well, there's a reason for for that. But she was a Christian who's a therapist, and she saw those principles just showing up in my lessons. But what she says to me is, I just got done caring for my husband who you know, had fairly recently passed. She was his caretaker for a long time. This is her just coming up to me after church. She says, and I just had to tell myself the truth all the time. You're a warrior. You can do this. And that idea of keep telling myself the truth, not because that's easy and not because that's everything, but it sure is a part of it, to keep reminding ourselves of the truth. And Psalm 42 and 43, originally one psalm. Psalm 42 is a really good example. I will say to my soul, this is what I'm going to tell my soul, right? I'm going to tell myself the truth. I'm not going to be led by my emotions. I'm going to lead. That idea. Great. What? Yes?
It's a good time to put in a plug for a book that's called Telling Yourself the Truth.
Yes, that is a good book.
It's an old book, actually.
Yeah, I mean like 40 years old. Not that old.
It's pretty old, but it's... I think that's pretty old for a book.
You sound like a 20-year-old. This really old book from the
90s. It's not like it's some new sort of technique.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's real basic.
Yeah, it is.
And it's very, I just break it down, and a lot of the cognitive things that you say to yourself unconsciously.
Yes.
And then working through, okay, well, how is that true? And just examine.
It is. It's huge. Yeah. Telling yourself the truth. And there's just a lot of ways that helps us with physical things and spiritual things. Good. What are some other practical things that David does when he's in the pit?
He asks for deliverance.
Ask God for help, right? Cast your burdens on God. Give him your requests. Good. What else? We kind of said this, but I like this language in verse 2. I pour out my complaint. And then he doesn't just tell his troubles. He says, end of verse 2, I tell my trouble before him, right? So he tells his troubles to God. He pours out what's wrong. We sometimes use the phrase, pour out your heart to God. That's from Psalm 62:8, but obviously a similar concept here. I will pour out my complaint. I will tell my trouble. So this articulating, right? People are against him. We see that in this idea of his relationship with people and how difficult, discouraging that is. He feels very alone. Now, I look at this. He says, no one takes notice of me. No refuge remains. No one cares for my soul. Is that literally true? I don't know. Maybe there's a small stage in David's life when he really had zero people around. We read in 1 Samuel, that wouldn't have even lasted for very long, because once he takes his family off to Moab, so they're okay, and he goes, you know, to the caves, he's pretty quickly surrounded by people, right? In fact, very loyal people. So I don't know if he was literally totally alone. I don't know if it's actually true that no one cared about him, but it sure feels like no one cares about him. And when we get to the Elijah story, we'll see this. Elijah knows that he's not the only prophet. But what does he keep saying? I'm the only one. I'm the only one that's left. I'm the only prophet. And you're like, Elijah, that's not true. You know better than that. Well, yeah, but he feels it. That's how he feels. So we got to be careful, right? Keep telling ourselves the truth with that, right? He feels like there's no safe place. He goes in a cave. It feels like a prison. Okay, right? But David puts his trust in God. Okay, so similar thoughts here. What can we learn about our relationship with God from Psalm 142. Yes. It's always there, no matter where you're at, no matter the circumstances around you. Good. Yeah, Diane.
He wants us to be real and let him know how we really feel.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, and if all of our prayers are really just generic and superficial, that's not going to be helpful. That's not going to help us, and that's not what God wants. That's not biblical. What's biblical is to articulate the problems. David will say in other Psalms, there's people in the city trying to kill me. Like, it's like, this, here's the data. Here's what's going on here. And he tells that to God, brings that to him, but not because it's hopeless, but rather this is his hope. This is where his hope is to bring it to God. And God's going to be his hope and his refuge. Is there a hand, Lawrence? Yeah.
Yeah. Just the idea that God can do what we can't. You know, he's talking about the fact that they are stronger than me. And if this is during the time when Saul was chasing him, comparing force to force, yes, they were stronger than him. There was no way he and his mighty men were going to take on a head-on confrontation with Saul and the army he had with him, just in pure human ability. So he's recognizing, Lord, they can overwhelm me. They catch up to me. There's no way out for me.
Yes. Yes.
You are. And it's the fact that he had that faith and understanding.
Yeah, absolutely. When we stop trying so hard to control and fix and say, God, this is too overwhelming, but I give the problem to you, that is such a point of growth, a point of maturing. And it's really just how we're going to ultimately rest, right? Is I can't handle this, but God, you can. I'm not going to be able to figure it out. And so that kind of need for micromanaging and control and anxiety, we don't have to handle it that way because God's the one who's in control. God's the one in charge. Very good.
And just sort of to add to that, is he approaches God knowing that he's going to help.
Yes, that's right.
I mean, it's that recognition that there's sort of an expectation that God's going to do the things that he needs done. Whether it's what he's asking for or not, it's the things that he needs.
Yes. Very few are the Psalms where they come to God and are kind of like, are you going to help? The majority are what you described, where they come to God and it's, I know you will bring me through this. Now, the fact that they come to God still when they're in such a bad place is still good. But more Psalms are like this, where they come to God and they say, you'll bring me through, right? Good. Yes, Stephen?
I jump back a little bit before that to show to my, I got to tell myself there's a relationship that's an opportunity there. But we often, like we've already talked about, is what is a relationship? Generally, what is a relationship? Is it, and it helps when I learned from my child that for me to dictate their life and to give them good things and to, guide their ways and into how to deal with life the best I know, that's kind of a relationship. It's a one-sided relationship. But when I see them go to school and they're under distress, is the relationship to where they'll come back to me for help. And God wants us, and again, just learning over the years, lamenting to God with a relationship. If we have a relationship with God, he wants us to lament to him. And that's what reminds me of what this psalm is. David is lamenting to him in a way that is respectful, honorable, glorifying God. And God is open to hear it.
Mm-hmm.
But it takes a relationship.
Yes.
Because if I have another child coming to me that I don't know, I want to help, but it's kind of like I can't jump into that relationship because we don't have a relationship. I can't go interfere with what you're doing because God's different, of course, but in a way, but we still need a relationship to be able to lament to him for his help, to know where he can help and where he can't.
Yep.
So it's just a big spot in a circle.
It is, and really fundamentally, relationship is a two-way street. It really involves things from both sides. Otherwise, I mean, you can call it a relationship, but it's really just a transaction or a dictatorship, you know, or something, right? So David puts his trust in God. He cries out to help. He states confidence that God will bless him in the end. And I love this. This is this relationship with others. He states his faith that he will have a community again. Did you guys notice that? He feels so alone, right? There's no one who cares about me. No one notices. But how does the psalm end? The righteous will surround me. He's looking forward to, there will be a time when I'm not alone. There will be a time when I'm going to be surrounded by friends, loved ones, righteous people. And so this loneliness is temporary. God will bring me out of that and bring me back into community. So relationship with God, he leans on God in sorrow, fear, loneliness, and feeling overwhelmed. He trusts God will rescue in the end. Relationship with people, he's alone now. People are against him, but he knows that God will bless him again. And he has this hope in what God can do. Okay. Other thoughts on Psalm 142 here? Yeah, Lauren.
When I read Psalms from David, I always try to think about what made him a man after God's own heart, because he's a very sinful man. So what makes him so different? And I think verse 7, set me free from my prison that I might praise your name.
Mm-hmm.
Then the righteous will gather about me, not because of me, but because of your goodness to me.
Mm-hmm.
So just that whole, like, not your will, but my will, like, let my ones be your ones, and that his goal in this is not just so he can go live in the palace and be king and have everyone adore him. It's so that God's goodness will shine.
Yes. Yeah, so remember when Nathan Ward was here a month or two ago, and Nathan said, tell God why you're asking for things, right? So don't just ask. So why should God help you in the job situation? Why should God help you or your family through this? And we're like, I don't know. I just don't like it, so I want to be different. That's a very good exercise. So David does that here. Bring me out of this so that I will give thanks to your name. He might say, in other contexts, the psalmist might say, that people would see and fear, right? See that you bless the righteous so that I can be with God's people again and lead them and all of that. So those are very helpful ideas. Okay, other, yes.
Enemies are real. We're going to have enemies. Saul, he knew the prophecy. If I recall this from my memory, there's an episode where he and David are having an exchange where Saul comes to one of his moments of repentance, and he declares, I know the Lord is going to make
peace.
He knows. And yet he knows. But when he's not in that moment of clarity, he's rebelling against God, trying to prevent it. And Phoebe and I were actually having a conversation yesterday when I was talking. We're talking about premillennialism and some of this crazy stuff you hear out there about, well, it's the end times and et cetera, et cetera. And I said, Revelation, you can look at it different ways. And I don't want to get too sidetracked here, but I said, you know, when I look at our nation, I can honestly say there's more persecution against the church than I can ever recall in the history of this nation, at least since we've been a nation. Now, does that mean the end times are coming? I said, but I also look at that and I compare it to what's going on in Christians in other parts of the world. I'm like, oh, we still got it pretty good.
Yeah.
I mean, this, you know, there's some bad things happening, and we don't want to make light of those, but has it risen to a level to all these, you know, red flags are going off and alarm bells? And
The sky's falling, yeah.
Right, but enemies are real, and some of those enemies in this world wouldn't mind just ending your life because they truly think, as Jesus said to the apostles, they think they're doing the will of God, or at the very least, they think they're doing right, whether they believe in God or not.
Yeah, good thoughts. Let's go to Psalm 131. Question that I asked here basically was, you know, I didn't literally have these exact words on the worksheet, but what stands out to you from a biopsychosocial spiritual perspective from this psalm? And of course, encouragement from this psalm. I love this psalm. And this is a psalm I give to the guys I talk to quite a bit. I call it the OCD psalm. And one of the guys goes, it's really more like the anti-OCD song. I was like, correct. This isn't to give you OCD. it's to help you. Right. So, okay. Does someone want to read Psalm 131 nice and loud?
Lord, my heart is not proud. My eyes are not haughty. I do not get involved in things too great or too difficult for me. Instead, I have calmed and quieted myself like a little weaned child with its mother. I am like a little child. Israel, put your hope in the Lord, both now and forever.
Okay. So we're looking at what are different elements here? Thinking elements, emotions, feelings, my body, relationships. Of course, what's the only real relationship in this psalm? What's that?
A child and
his mother. Child and mother, yes. That's the picture of what relationship?
Us with God.
Us with God, yeah. So the picture of that is the child and his mother. Okay, so you tell me, what what do you see in this psalm related to body things, thinking things, emotions, relationships, and spiritual things?
Well, for the thinking, I didn't have one for the body. I think now. But for the thinking, it's accepting of my limitations. And
yes, exactly.
That's huge.
Huge. Okay. So that second verse, I need to, it's still the end of the first verse, sorry. I do not occupy myself with things too great and too marvelous for me. I'm not God. God is God. There's going to be things I'm not going to be able to figure out. And in our kind of scientific age, we're so educated and philosophical and, you know, 1,000 years ago, they didn't know anything about how plants grew. We're like, I learned in seventh grade how plants grow. You know what I mean? Like, and to say, you know, there are going to be things that are too great and too marvelous for me. And so, therefore, my heart's not lifted up. My eyes aren't raised too high. And I'm not going to let those things bother me. Instead, I have a different response. Very powerful. Very powerful thought. Yeah, I'll take it, actually. Lord?
So, some people say, you know, when David says, my eyes are not haughty, he's basically saying he's proud of being humble. Mm-hmm. But he's really saying that he has an inner disposition of humility.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I don't see pride here. Yeah. Good. Heather?
Well, when we were discussing this at home, I was really thinking, clearly the psalmist, there's a whole of one, Psalm 119 about meditating on God's law, which is clearly lofty and wondrous and marvelous, right? So not the idea that we don't think on those things, but the main point of this being humility, that I stay in my lane when I think about those things. And so if I'm finding like, oh, I really want to answer this question, what's my motivation behind that? Is it to think how wonderful God is? Is that my conclusion? Or is it to figure out something? Am I trying to reason my way out of something he wants me to do or out of who he is? Is it just learning for the sake of learning, being wise, which we're cautioned against?
Yeah, very good. So when I come to that point, wrestling with something, don't get too caught up into it. Don't get too swept into that. Look at that. Yeah, wow, I'm really overly concerned with this. What's going on here? Good. Other thoughts? Lauren, did you have a hand? Yeah.
Oh, sorry. I mean, I have thoughts. But. Well, when I was struggling with anxiety, my doctor said to me, like, we live in a time where we know every single bad thing that's occurring every place in the world. And we're really not meant to be so inundated.
Yeah.
So helpless, like we can't help, and we feel like we need to do things. You know, the tragedy in Texas, it was really hard for me to not be consumed with thoughts about how awful and terrible and everything that is, but I don't have any control over it. And so just to not be so, I don't know, taken in by every bad thing that's going on.
Yes.
Focus on where we can be helpful.
Yeah, I think you're right. I don't think that there's some really difficult and bad sides to the technological age of knowing every bad thing, every scary thing, every disastrous thing. just in human history, we didn't, you know.
It's called doom scrolling.
Yeah. When I get really sucked into that, you know, 150 years ago, you send the men off to war, you get a letter occasionally, you know, but and we're not hearing about earthquakes in Thailand, you know, and we just can't even keep up with, you know, people complain rightfully. We focus so much on, say, conflict in the Middle East and care basically nothing about all the conflicts throughout Africa. You know, in nation after nation, they're in turmoil. We don't even hear about that. But, like, I'm supposed to hear about even more? Like, I'm supposed to care about all that plus more? So it is. It's a hard thing. Good. Other thoughts?
It doesn't actually spell it out. I was just thinking the bio part. It doesn't say sit down and take a breath and, you know, yoga or whatever. But that I have calm and quiet in my soul. It just reminds me of God has given us ways in which we can kind of, like,
Yeah.
I don't know if that's...
It really is. So here's why I think it's very appropriate in the context to tie that in with body things. When he talks about calming and quieting his soul, is that just this intellectual thing? What does he compare it to? Like a little kid with his mom, right? And the weaned is like satisfied, right? So it's not the baby that's like crying, feed me. It's the sleeping child, it's the calm child, it's the fed, content child. How does that connect with verse 1's concern about these thoughts too marvelous for me? Is that child that rested, contented child thinking about all these thoughts? No, but that's very much a body picture of a kid with his mom and this place of calm, rest, you know, warm, comfort, peace, right? I mean, all those things. That's a body thing. That, you know, so I've made my soul like this child. His mother. Good. Someone else make a comment. Hey, David.
I see something interesting that corresponds with this. Not the opposite, but you might think it is to start with. James, when he says, you know, if you seek wisdom, you should pray from God. He'll give you that wisdom. Well, here he's basically saying, I know that there are things that I shouldn't be trying to think that I should do. I know that you can do them. Just like a weaned child can go up to his mother and know, you will provide for me.
Mm-hmm.
You have provided for me. And you will yet again provide for me. So I lean on you to provide for me. To
yes.
Me. That wisdom we can pray for, God teach me. What's in your control and what's in my control? Let me know by your wisdom where I should fit in.
Yeah. And just to clarify, when it says weaned child with his mother, I'm not picturing a 4-year-old coming up and having a conversation. I'm picturing, like, I think a picture with his mother is like being held by the mother, which is why Corinne's comment from a few days ago reminded me of this psalm, right? That picture of God holding us in his arms. That's Isaiah 40, Jesus holding the sheep in his arms, you know, all of that.
A present from Josh.
Thank you. I have some biological needs right now. Was there a hand in the back? Was it Heather?
Yeah. Well, when you think about the child with his mother like that, to Kat's point, that's somebody who's in physical community with someone. It's someone who's had physical touch with someone. And somebody who has been physically fed, right? And all of those things have to do with our body. I mean, that when we hug each other, what is it, a 20-second hug is how much you have to touch to release the oxytocin.
Mm-hmm.
There is something about that physical touch that is really important when people don't have it. We know there's all kinds of developmental delays with children who don't get that.
Yes, yes.
With old people who don't get that.
Yes.
So just those things really do bring out the body aspect. If I feel anxious, a hug can help.
Yes.
I will share being with someone.
Good food, right?
Yes.
How many mothers say the way to a boy's heart is through his stomach, right? Mm-hmm. You know, and I know a lot of wise moms. They're like, I'm going to take my son out to a restaurant and fill his belly with good food, and that's when he will open up. and he will start sharing things with me, right? It's, it might sound emotionally manipulative, but it's not. It's the best, right? So that kind of idea. All this is very real. It may take 13 second hug, 20 second hug to get an oxytocin release, but there is a neurological change even just from a handshake. So there's even a response to something very small like that. Okay, so we've hit on some good things here. Emotions, body, relationships, thinking. What else do you want to pull out from this psalm along these lines? Can we see how the spiritual is like the biology and the thinking and the relationship? It's like not this totally separate thing. It's like woven in with that together, because I'm going to learn to rest in God. And rest is primarily a body thing. I know our minds can rest, but even that feels like, oh, I'm when my mind is rested, it's like my body's rested. And so this idea of finding rest and peace in God, then of course our thinking, right? The thinking is huge in this psalm, and it's because it's a relationship that God cares for me, and I can find rest and peace in God like a child with his mother. And so that is very spiritual, connected to all these other things. Yeah, Lawrence.
Yeah, the rest and peace, that's there because of the hope mentioned in the last verse.
Mm-hmm.
That hope really is real within us. When we dwell on that, we'll have rest, we'll have peace, we'll know we're taken care of, because that's what allows for those things. And you mentioned the social aspect with God, but then there's just a social aspect with those we're in community with, serving God. Here it's Israel.
Israel, yep.
Israel. And he's, the psalm serves several purposes, but one of them is just simply a call to Israel. Remember
yes.
who your God is. Remember
yes.
we're to be a community in this effort.
Yes. Yes, very good. Elias.
Very similar. Just the end, the words hope from the psychological, and then mentions a relationship with God, the social at the end.
Yeah, very good. Love that psalm. That's a really, really good psalm. Now let's look at Psalm 18. Same question.
5 minute warning. 5 minute warning.
Is that really 5 minute warning? We're going to take it that way. Okay, same question. What stands out from a biopsychosocial perspective from Psalm 18? What are some thinking things, some emotion things, body things, relationship things, especially connected, of course, to God, the spiritual things? What stands out to you from Psalm 18? I mean, no one has a Bible study in Psalm 18 and says, let's talk about the biopsychosocial spiritual elements of the psalm. But it's a great psalm, and it's all there. It's all there because this is what our life is. This is how God made us. It's like this is how reality is. So therefore, my relationship with God shows up in these ways. Okay, your thoughts.
His body feels strong. He feels sure-footed. He's the bow of bronze.
Isn't that interesting? Isn't that interesting? Because of God's help in my life, he trains my fingers for war. With him, I can leap over a wall. I can bend a bow of bronze. Even verse 1, I love you, O Lord, my strength. God giving me strength. God giving me the help that I need. Now, verse 28, by you I can run against a troop. My God, I can leap over a wall. Verse 32, the God who equipped me with strength and made my way blameless. So all these pictures of strength and equipping and helping, this is a great psalm about the Holy Spirit, of God's Spirit filling me and giving me strength. This is very connected to passages like Zechariah 4, Acts 3, you name it. But this is God helping me and giving me encouragement, strength, motivation, the help I need. That impacts us physically. That is a physical thing that's going to be impactful for us. Good. Very good. Other thoughts? Really in death, yeah.
And after he wrote and wrote and wrote, he felt strong.
Yeah, I mean, I suspect this is like, he's not, the psalm doesn't, this psalm doesn't to me feel like the therapy. This is like, this happened, but and I'm already in a good place, and I'm going to tell you about what the bad thing that happened. So God brings him through this death, really. I mean, it's the cords of death ensnared him, right? The cords of Sheol, the snares of death. And then God rescues him, and of course, this sounds just like the cross. I mean, this is David's life that made to look like Jesus's life. So God bring him through that. Other thoughts here? Yeah, Heather.
I don't know if you would count this, and I wouldn't die on this hill, but it sounds like this was a cry that he vocalized.
Mm.
And sometimes I think that is powerful when I'm talking to God, that it's actually out loud,
mm-hmm.
especially in distress. I think about Hannah's prayer had to be very physical for Eli to say, are you drunk?
Mm-hmm.
You know, it wasn't just a bowing of the head. And I wonder if that using our body
yes.
that way
yes.
also is impactful.
I think it is. In verse 6, it does say, he heard my voice, my cry to him. So in general, the ancients read out loud and prayed out loud. It's not like you have to. The point is not that you have to read out loud and pray out loud. But I do think there's benefit to that that is good for us to work towards, to pray more out loud. And that just makes it more real.
End of class.
That was not 5 minutes. That makes it more real. Any other thoughts as we're wrapping this up?
To me, verse 6 is a tutorial on relationship with God.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he tells us that he turned to God and God brought him through.
Yes.
Right? And so it's a tool for us to say, okay, I'm anxious, I'm overwhelmed,
Yes, very, very good. Good. Well, I appreciate you guys going through all that. So we are ready for, God willing, on Wednesday, start our next unit, which is how we fall into the pit, principles of the pit, how we struggle. So we've talked about that God made us this way, and now we're going to talk about when the wheels fall off the wagon. Thank you. Nope.
Stay out of the pit.
Stay out of the pit. If I think of any homework, I'll just email.